Texo's CEO, Melanie Rainey, is taking a seat on the Pressure Tested podcast today. Get ready for a candid conversation about the construction industry's labor issues, the unique challenges women face in the field, and where the future of construction is headed. Melanie, thank you so much for agreeing to be on the Too Big to Fail podcast.
Yes.
Melanie, tell me a little bit about how long you've been with Texo.
So I've been with Texo coming up on 10 years in October of this year, which is crazy. It's gone by so fast.
Wow. And so where did you come from before? Was it Beck?
Yes, I worked at Beck for 9 years. I started in architecture and then I moved into construction and then I moved into business development. And so I was there for 9 years and then in 2013 made the leap to Texo.
I was just looking at your LinkedIn and it said that you did federal programs and then somebody gave you a recommendation for the work you did while you were in federal programs. What was that about?
So in 2008, 2009, when the market started to crash, Beck decided that they wanted to go pursue FedGov projects just to diversify their portfolio, which I think is a great idea. And so I was just getting into business development at that point, and I can talk to a brick wall. I just enjoy having conversations with anybody. And so they moved me into business development and told me to go pursue FedGov projects. And so I started up the FedGov pursuits, and we did that in January of 2009. And in June, we were awarded our first GSA contract, which kind of launched the Beck FedGov market pursuits. So it was pretty exciting.
Wow. So a company like Beck, like what kind of, I don't know if you can even answer this, but like what kind of revenue does a company like that do? Is it in the billions?
I think they just surpassed a billion.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. And how much of that work is public work, you think?
Not much of it anymore, I don't think. Mm-hmm. They're mostly a private negotiated GC, I think. Been removed for about 10 years. So,
right.
But I think majority of it is private negotiated.
So you came out of college, OU, and your goal was to work in construction or kind of what you had? You have an architecture degree.
Correct. Yes.
Okay.
So I'm from a really small town in Oklahoma, and they didn't really talk much about careers at that point in the super small town. I'm from about 3,500 people in our town. And so I'm a math nerd, absolutely love math. And my sophomore year of high school, I had a teacher who sent me to engineering camp at Oklahoma State University. And I was exposed to all sorts of different engineering careers, and I really was drawn to the structural engineering degree. And so I started with engineering I wanted to be a structural engineer. And then I got a few days into that and realized that was probably not for me. I thought that, but it actually wasn't once I started it. And I walked into the architecture program and it was complete chaos everywhere. There was cardboard everywhere. There was loud music blaring. And I was like, these are my people. And so I picked up architecture as my major. And then 2 years into studying architecture, we were in the basement studying, which is where the library was at, and there was these group of guys over in the corner working on actually how you put the building together. And so I was like, what are they studying? Like, that sounds more appealing than what I'm designing over here. And come to find out it was construction management, which I never even knew was an option as a career. And so I picked up that as a minor. So I graduated with a architecture major and a construction management minor, and I wanted to do design build. And I had a professor that said, you really have only a few options if you want to do true design build. And Beck was one of them. So I interned with them before my senior year and then came back once I graduated and worked for them full time.
I think it's really cool the impact one teacher and one professor can have on just your whole life. I had something very similar. So I'm from a small town. I'm from Breckenridge, Texas, like population 5,000 and declining. And I had just this amazing math teacher. She taught math all 4 years. And she was just such a strong, independent woman. She was really the first like role model I had for a strong, independent woman. And she told me to do something with math too. And so after that, I was going to find some way to do something with math because somebody had told me that I had an aptitude there.
Right.
And I think that is so important for a young person.
Oh, yeah.
To have that, somebody to just recognize something that they're good at and help them go in a direction. So minor construction management.
Yes.
Very cool. I also didn't know construction management was a thing. I didn't know that until I got to Moss Utilities, really. Like, you just don't, that's not a degree that's very well publicized, you know.
We're trying to change that, but I agree with you completely. Is when you think of construction, you think of hammer, nails, pouring concrete on the side of the road, bending rebar. Like, that's what's what you typically see. You don't see the job site trailer, all of the engineering happening behind it, all of the coordination of the subs. Like, you don't see any of that, and that's what we're trying to spread the word about at Texo. Is this is an incredible career past what you see when you're driving down the road.
How are you guys working on that at Texo?
So we have a specific entity dedicated towards workforce development. It's called the Texo Foundation, and it is solely focused on bringing people into the construction industry and changing the perception of what it is to be in construction. So our tagline is Build Texas Proud. There's an innate pride that comes with being in construction. Every time I drive by a building that I worked on, I tell my stepsons, like, I worked on that project, like, I helped build that. And so it is, we're in high schools, we're in colleges, and we're in about 70 high schools in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And if students are studying construction in the CTE program, then we are trying to be that bridge that once they graduate, they actually know members in the construction industry, or they're going to a school to study construction management. So we're trying to bridge that gap. So if they're actually looking at construction in high school, one, we're exposing them. If they don't know about it, we're telling them about it. And then two, if they are actually studying it, we don't lose them. We bring them into the industry and capture the kids that have learned about the industry in high school.
That's amazing. So Garrett talks a lot about that. We should all have that conversation sometime, because we are also really interested in that. And I think that it's just fighting this perception that people have said for so many years where, you know, you don't want to grow up and dig ditches, or you don't want to. And it's like, the guys that dig ditches for Moss Utilities make great money.
Yes.
Make so much more money than all the people that went to college for a four-year degree in philosophy and English. And I love my philosophy and English majors, but it's just, I think that there's so much of a stereotype over you don't want to be the person that's using their hands. And we really see it in the mechanical company too. So a lot of the blue-collar trade that have been installing air conditioners and fixing air conditioners for years, they're all getting ready to retire. And very few people want to get into it. So we have a couple of people over there that are either in their first year of college, or they're between high school and college, and we're trying to help them, you know, kind of pursue something in the construction management
field. That's awesome. And it's something that people can never take away. Like,
absolutely.
You may see a ditch digger, but there's a decent amount of math that goes behind everything that you do in construction. And so there's a domino effect everywhere on a job site. So all of the trades having to work together, and it's a lot more complicated than people think. And once you learn that, it's a skill that nobody can ever take away. Like, you can always have a career. There's always construction happening somewhere in this country or somewhere on this planet. And so that's what we try to express, is once you have this skill, you can always have a career, a very lucrative career, to your point.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I also agree completely with what you said about how if you'd worked on a building, you still will talk about that.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was a project manager at Moss Utilities, and pretty much any project I worked on, my 7-year-old daughter knows that I worked on that project. She doesn't necessarily know what I did. Like, she might think I built the building with my own hands. But she can point them out. She can say, "Oh, Mom, that was your project." Yeah, it's super cool. Once you have that, you're like, yeah, it's just like a piece of you a little bit.
Yes.
Like, it's almost even creative at some point. Like, you feel like you really just like built something.
Yeah.
I love that.
The built environment. You literally did.
So speaking of kids, tell me about your kids. How many kids do you have?
I have 4 stepsons, all teenage boys.
Holy bagoli.
Yes. It is a very busy household right now. So they're 13, 15, 16, and 18. So one just graduated. He's about to head to A&M. And so it is a very busy household.
That is amazing.
Yes.
Do they all play sports?
Oh, yeah. At least one. Several of them are into a couple, and the youngest one will play anything that has a ball in it. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. We actually just put up a basketball goal in our living room last night. So it was a pretty big win for him. I think it's the happiest I've seen him in 5 years.
That's so amazing. I have to drag my daughter, because I was a big sports person growing up. I have to drag my daughter kicking and screaming to every sporting event I want her to do. I mean, I pretty much had to bribe her to play basketball for 2 years. And I think the day that I told her that I wasn't going to force her to play basketball anymore was like the happiest day she's ever had. She could just like really care less about that kind of stuff. She's like, she's a creative brain. You know, she wants to, you know, be a fashion designer. And she can already put on makeup better than I can. Like, she's just a girl. She's a girly girl.
Well, and that can come in handy, because I don't think about stuff like that. So I would love to have that input, you know?
Yeah. I'm kind of right in between. Like, I care enough about, you know, learning how to do the makeup, but it's not the very first. Like, I'll come to work completely without makeup and walk in, and sometimes people give me that look like,
are you sick?
She must not be having a good day. I'm like, guys, I just didn't wear makeup. Calm down. It's all going to be okay.
It's
perfectly fine. Yeah. So let's talk about what it's like to be a female in the construction industry. What, if any, you know, roadblocks did you have starting out at Beck as a female?
To give them credit, I have actually always viewed it as a positive, as an advantage. Like, anytime you're talking about females in construction, the typical response is the catcalling and the comments on job sites and feeling left out. And I have all those stories. I've shared a pretty common story about the iron workers following me around the job site based off my perfume, and they were talking about it. And that was kind of the first time that I was like, oh, gee whiz, I guess I really am different on this job site. You know, I've got hair coming out of my hard hat. Like, I am different. And that was the first point that I didn't really know how to handle that. And thankfully, we had a great superintendent on the job site that helped walk me through how to confront them and tell them that it's not acceptable to do that. And
male or female?
They were all
males. Was the superintendent male?
Oh, he was male. Uh-huh. And he had three daughters, which I think helped him. He understood that I was struggling with it and didn't know what to do. And he helped walk me through that situation and made me confront them, but he was right behind me the whole time. And so, and that happened about 6 months out of college for me. So it was pretty fresh in my career. And, you know, I have situations that have happened a year ago that, you know, you have an awkward conversation and you have to nip it in the bud. And so it hasn't ever stopped. The thing that I really like to focus on is it's always been a differentiator for me, even in college. I was about the only female. There were two females in the construction management department or group at OU, and I had a professor once point out that our group won or made an A in the highest A because they had somebody in their group that thought differently, and it was me. He's like, she thinks differently than all you guys. She's a female. Her brain works different. And so that is kind of what set my mentality of, yes, I look different. I am different sitting at this table, but that also means that I bring a completely different perspective and experience to this table. So I think you have to be technically sound and you have to earn the respect sitting at the table. But once you figure out how to be teammates with them and they value that different opinion. And so I've always tried to use it as a differentiator. I walk into the office and I automatically look different. So how can I use this as an advantage to help the team?
That's an amazing perspective. I don't know that I got to that perspective as early as you did. I think I spent a good early part of my career pissed off that I was always the person in the room that, especially like in a pre-con situation, like go to the pre-con meeting and you're meeting with an owner or a GC, and I would bring an assistant project manager with me, you know, a man that knew absolutely nothing, and they would consistently always ask him the questions over me. And, you know, at first it pissed me off, and I can recount a lot of situations like that, but, you know, I think it's just made me so tough. It's made me so tough. Like, there is not a man in the world that intimidates me. Oftentimes, I'm much more intimidated by the strong female in the room than I am any man. I was just sitting in a room with the treasurer of Austin Industries, just a strong female. And you could tell that you did not get in her way. And I was just so in awe of this. I barely talked to her because I'm a nervous Nelly. But I just thought, wow, what a cool woman who's just so sure of herself. Yeah, I think that mostly it just made me tough, though.
Yeah.
Once you get past being mad about it, I think that that's something that happens for women is they they get mad and they feel like it's not fair. And when you focus on being mad and not fair, you don't get anything out of it.
Right. I think there so much comes back to just an insecurity. Like, if I'm secure with myself and I'm strictly competing with myself, how can I build other people up? Having the confidence in myself that knowing that I'm a good leader and a good teammate and a good construction manager, like, if I have that security inside of me, my hope is that I can build up everybody else and not see them as a threat or competition. I'm good with who I am.
That also takes a lot of growth.
Yeah,
you do not graduate college with that inside you. I think that, especially for me, like, I've always been a really competitive person. So I almost feel like I'm always competing with the person sitting next to me, which is, that's like not a personality trait that I'm proud of, because I'm just constantly competing. It's who I am. And sometimes I feel like I could be a much better leader if I was more focused on how do I bring the whole team up. So that's really interesting that you said. So how would you describe your overall leadership style, and like, what challenges have you dealt with at Texo, being the leader of Texo for 10 years?
Man, what challenges have I not dealt with is probably the real question. I firmly believe in being a servant leader, of not asking our team to do anything that I wouldn't go do. And I would say that's probably the foundation of my leadership philosophy, if I had to spell it out, is I view us as a team, and so I want to step in and help people grow and develop, and I want every day, I want us to level up and be better than that we were the day before as a team, and so we're all in it all the time. And so the hardest part for me was actually taking over a company, because it was I was 33 when I was promoted to CEO, and so I had come from the architecture, the construction world, so I knew that really well. What I didn't know was the nonprofit and then everything that comes along with running a business. And so at every point in my career, I've said that I've been kicked off the end of a dock, and you just have to figure out how to swim or sink, and I don't like to sink, so I'm gonna have to figure out how to swim. So the first few years it's actually a big blur, because I was trying to build the relationship with the members, earn their trust, earn their respect, have the very candid conversations about where Texo needed to go, because we were at an inflection point there, and we were now on our way up, thankfully, and we were gaining members and we were gaining revenue, and so I didn't want to lose any of that momentum. But then I was also trying to replace myself, so I had been promoted and I needed to backfill that position, and then also learn just the intricacies of running a business. So health insurance, 401k, everything that comes along with that. We're a very small organization, and so a lot of that landed on me. I mean, I was doing payroll for the first 4 or 5 years that I was there, and so that's a lot to manage, being the outward-facing CEO and then also the operations person internally. So that was hands down the biggest. It's hard to describe sometimes Texo to people, but you know, we have 260 contractors that are members. That's a whole lot of people that I technically report to. Mm-hmm. This is your association. And so that's a lot to balance and a lot to manage.
That's a lot of expectations. A lot of expectations. And so you we're not a public company, so I didn't really understand how all of this worked. But you report to a board. So a board basically tells you, Melanie, you're doing a great job, or Melanie, you are not doing a great job.
Right.
And so how was that? I mean, do you have constructive feedback from them coming to you, or do they really trust you to do what you need to do to run the company?
It's a little bit of everything. So I call our board of directors my bumpers. And so I'm the one that's out there having the conversations, or our team is, with the members. And so when I have all these conversations, I try to find the trends of what people are saying, and then people tell me exactly where Texo needs to go. Like, they don't hold that back. They may not know that's what they're telling me, but they're giving me feedback on what they're seeing in their company, with their people, with markets, you know, trends, all that stuff. So if you narrow, most of the conversations have some pretty similar threads, and so that tells me where Texo needs to go. And then I love to use our board of directors as bumpers to tell me, yes, keep going, run as fast as you can, or man, I think that's a little bit off. Let's do a pilot program and maybe check what your gut's telling you, and then we can run. But the credit that I have to give our board is they've never wanted Texo to fit in this association box. Most associations look pretty similar. And I feel like our board of directors have always said, you go do whatever the industry tells you we need to do, and we're going to remove the barriers for you. So if we need to create a women's executive leadership program, we're going to help you figure out how to do that. If we need to develop a, you know, the executive development partners program, we're going to help you figure out how to do it. Like, they've always given us permission to try things and to fail, and just to do new things that energize the industry versus doing the exact same thing every single year and people getting, you know, bored and burned out.
Yeah, I think you said something really important there, is that when you don't have the creative, or when you don't have the ability to go out and make your own plans and be allowed to fail, even if it's fail spectacularly, you get burned out.
Right.
Because you don't feel like you are, you have the ability to make the change that you see. And so that probably speaks a lot to why you've been able to do this for as long as you have. I mean, I think that it's very common to see in today's world that people last in roles, you know, 2-3 years,
right,
and then they get ready to go do something else. But I think a lot of that can be attributed to people get burned out because they get told no. They get told no,
right,
and people don't like their ideas. And that's really hard. When people don't like your ideas, and they won't, even if you don't like somebody's idea, I try to do this with people that I manage. If somebody comes to me with a terrible idea, and I'm like, man, that is a bad idea. Sometimes, and I'm not saying every time, but sometimes I allow them to go out and fail.
Right.
Because I feel like they are going to learn so much more from being allowed to make a decision and see it through than for me to just be like, no, that's a terrible idea.
Right.
And so I want to give the people that I manage that freedom. It's probably, I love Garrett Moss to death. He's my best friend, but that's where him and I will butt heads. He'll say no, and I'll say yes. I'm like, just let me try it.
Right?
Just let me run. Just let me fail. And he's
right.
Like, nope, not going to do it. You know, but that's his management style. His management style is, I want to take care of the people around me, and I want to keep them from having to go through anything tough. And so it's just kind of a difference in who we are. So tell me about an initiative you're working on with Texo right now. Like, what are your major plans for this year?
Oh, man.
We're already halfway through the year.
Right,
so.
We are. We're actually already working on 2024.
Really?
The calendar. We typically try to plan about a year in advance.
Oh, cool.
My team, if they listen to this, they may actually freak out a little bit because I don't know how much I've shared with them about this.
I love that.
So, sorry, Texo team. I think we have a huge opportunity with the superintendents that are retiring right now. We have a major gap with superintendent knowledge between the Gen Xers and mm-hmm. the baby boomer, and we've got to somehow figure out a way to transfer that knowledge from the boomers that have been building our buildings for, you know, 40 plus years. We've got to figure out how to transfer that knowledge to the younger generation, because we have two major gaps in our workforce, and that I continually hear that. And so I think we need to have some sort of mentoring program that helps companies facilitate a program that helps transfer that knowledge. So
how are you going to do that?
That's working with a facilitator to try and design a mentoring program.
Awesome.
That, you know, Texo could facilitate this, but so much of what the superintendents do is with the company. It's very company specific.
Yeah.
And so I think Texo could do part of this, but another part of this has to be on the company to transfer that, you know, just the intellectual property of that company, if you want to say it that way. But so that is that's one of the big things, one of the big trends that I keep hearing that we're trying to figure out how to help companies solve.
I think that people are funny about transferring knowledge. Some people are almost scared to transfer the knowledge that they have because they feel like it's going to replace them. Instead of it adding value to the entire organization, they see it as a way of them getting replaced.
Right.
And if you could somehow change that in people's minds, and I mean, I can't think of a better thing for a 60-year-old superintendent who's 5 years from retirement, or maybe he's getting ready to retire now, like to have those couple of years where he moves into the office, where he starts training other people, where his
right.
job responsibilities change. But I think that people get so nervous. They get so nervous when you have this idea of how things are going to look completely different. And if they can't see it, it becomes very difficult for them to want to do it. But you're absolutely right. When I look back at my career, it's because older people sat down and transferred knowledge. Like, right. I wouldn't be anywhere that I am today if there's somebody I talk about a lot, Rick Marino. He was an interim CFO for us for Seton Hill. You may be familiar with Seton Hill. But he just made it his duty to come in 8 hours a week and transfer knowledge.
That's awesome.
And, there's no way to ever repay something like that.
Right.
And I wish you all the luck with that endeavor. I think that is such a fantastic thing to do. It would be tough to figure out how companies sponsor that, though, and how to convince companies that it's necessary, which I guess that's pretty much your whole job, huh?
It is. And what I like to do is keep track of where I have these conversations and who tells me things like this. And then when we go launch this, I already have 10 companies in the wing that are ready to be, I like to call things pilot programs when we're launching them. And that's part of creating that environment where it's okay to fail. It's okay if a pilot program fails. That's no big deal. And so I like to create these little pilot program pockets and roll it out with a few companies that I know have interest in it, and I vetted it with them. And I think half of it is creating the environment with the younger generation to learn also, of not going into it thinking that we have it all figured out, going into it realizing that we actually have a lot to learn, and this person has built a 60-story building. I can learn a lot from him if I just shut my mouth and listen.
That's solid advice. That's more solid advice that it's taken me years to learn. I think I just posted something on LinkedIn about how, sometimes you just don't have all the answers.
And
be quiet. Let somebody else tell you.
Right?
me either. I mean, I'll tell you I do, but I don't ever have all of the answers either. And that's something that I'm working on personally, is just when I'm in a room with people who are smarter than I am, who have more experience than I do, and that's every single day. What can I learn from this person? What can I take? I tapped on the table.
Oh, no. It'll be
sorry.
Okay.
It is loud, though. And I'm such a tapper, too. Okay, so let me ask you this. We were talking about this today in a segue. We have a segue before all of our meetings to kind of get, just everybody to pay attention to the meeting. And our segue was, what is the best piece of career advice you've ever been given?
That's a really good question. Something that I always lean on is, I think it's Patrick Lencioni that's always about stay humble and stay hungry. And that has all, I feel like, keeps me pretty grounded. Like I don't ever want to get, my grandma would say, too big for your britches. Like, you don't ever want to think that you're more than you really are. And then if you stay hungry, going back to the piece we were just talking about, you can always learn something. We have a couple of people in their 20s in our office, and they're continually teaching me things. So knowing that every day I don't have all the answers, and being secure enough with myself to say, I do know that I'm a good leader. I do know that I'm a good teammate. I'm secure in several areas, but I can always get better. I can always become a better leader. I can always become a better communicator. Knowing that there's always room for improvement, I think, keeps you grounded. And then I keep a little sticky note on my computer that says, be so good they can't ignore you. And that kind of goes back to that every day I can be a little bit better. And I appreciate being confident. I don't ever want to be arrogant. And I always want to know that I'm technically sound and I'm executing really well to the highest level possible. And so that keeps me going in the sense of everything that Texo produces and everything that I produce, I want it to be excellent. So those are the things that I lean on pretty much every single day.
That sounds a whole lot like, and I'm sure you've read this book, Good to Great.
Oh, yeah.
Level 5 Leadership. Yep. I mean, I think you just completely nailed what that whole first chapter is about. I don't think that everybody's born with all of the qualities that you have. I think that humbleness is something that people have to learn. And I think you've done a great job with your humility.
Thanks.
You seem to be very level in all interactions. The first time I met you, I was a little nervous to walk up to you, and I just felt so comfortable after talking to you.
Oh, thanks.
And I think that that's a skill set not everybody has.
Was the first time at that at the BMO?
Gardnuity? It was. Gardnuity.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. Another thing I was going to want to ask you is, how do you handle, and I'm sure you handle it great based on your last answer, how do you deal with just a bad email? Let's say that somebody sends you just, and I'm going to say a cuss word, but just a shit email.
Right.
And they just nail you. And you know that it's not your fault. What do you do?
I usually get those phone calls.
Okay. So, even better?
Yeah. So you have to react in the moment. The thing I've had to learn with emails is to sit on it. Because I from all the personality assessments that you have to take, you know, in the professional world, I have very quick knee-jerk reactions. So I will see something and I have an opinion within 2 seconds or 3 seconds. And my face is probably going to tell you what that opinion is. So I've had to learn that that's my immediate reaction, is that was a very quick, quick-witted opinion, and it's probably not based on facts. So let's step back, reread the email. And then the other book that I absolutely love is Extreme Ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do believe that in every situation, there's probably something that I could have done better. So there's a natural response when reading that email to blame other people and be a victim, or and so I have to just try and put the lens on of, could I have made this situation better? Is there something I need to apologize for? And maybe it's not. Maybe it's 100% on somebody else. But there's a couple of different lenses that I have really had to work hard at putting on my mental response before I actually type out an email. And sometimes I've noticed that if I don't physically respond to the email and I call them, people are less apt to be that angry on a phone call versus an email.
Keyboard warriors.
Right. Yes. And so if I could just sit down with you and have a face-to-face conversation, I bet you we could come to some agreement. And if I need to apologize, I will 100% apologize. And what part of this do I need to own, and what part of this can I get better? But
That's really good. You mentioned the lens principle. So when I was early in my career, this should give you some idea of how good I was with people. But one of my mentors encouraged me very strongly to read a book called Winning with People by John C. Maxwell.
Right.
And he talks about the lens principle, uh-huh. about how you need to view the situation from a different lens. So what I had said in the meeting this morning was, you know, the best advice somebody ever gave me was just to always take the high road.
Right.
Just never fire back. Just take the high road and you will come out just in a better place. And
right.
So I try to stick to that, but that is not always.
And don't look at emails while you're drinking.
Oh, absolutely not. No. If you are out having a good time, you've had a couple drinks.
Don't look
at
emails.
That email from your boss, just don't read it.
Right.
Read it tomorrow.
Yes.
You didn't
sit
see
on
it. Yeah. Also, usually if I get an email after 4:30 or 5:30, it's not a great email. And so I never let myself respond.
I think that's a great rule.
I type out so many responses. I type out so many text responses, email responses, but I don't send them.
Right.
And usually, like, if I'm really upset about it, I've kind of solved my own problem just talking to myself.
I think that's genius.
Well,
yes. Whatever
it
works
sometimes.
Right?
Some days I'm still mad the next day and have to have a conversation for sure. So what do you think's next? Do you think you're going to stay at Texo? Do you have any other plans for the future? You probably don't want the Texo board hearing in this, but
I have nothing to hide. I absolutely love what I do.
That's amazing.
So my husband and I were actually just in Park City for 10 days. I had two conferences that were back to back in the same city, which was kind of crazy. So I was gone for 10 days, all for work stuff. But I came back, I was ready to be home. But then I came back and I was like, I miss walking into the Texo office. I miss our Texo team. Like, and what a cool blessing to absolutely love what you do. And my husband would probably tell you that I think about Texo and talk about Texo a little bit too much. So, but I'm all in, and I absolutely, because we're changing lives. That is the piece that I absolutely love what Texo is doing, is Texo is the people association. So we are investing in people and helping to change the trajectory of their lives. And so that passion for people, and then specifically people in construction, is what drives me. And so I honestly can't, I mean, this is a big market. Everybody's always fishing for more people. So people are always like, are you happy at Texo? Do you like what you're
doing? Oh, yeah.
Do you like
what
you're doing?
Yeah.
And it's always, I absolutely love it, and I cannot imagine doing anything else. So not saying, I'm sure the Lord has something else at some mm-hmm. point in my future. And so whatever that is, you know, I'll give it everything that I've got to. But at this moment, I can't think about doing anything else.
What do you really attribute that to? I mean, I think that a lot of people can believe wholeheartedly in the mission of their organization and still run into roadblocks professionally every day. You know, like I talked about, if somebody doesn't like my idea, you know, I'll take that real personally. What do you think about the Texo culture is it keeps you coming back from vacation saying, I love this place and I want to keep going? Do you think it's really the mission, or do you think that you've built just an incredible company culture as well?
That's a really good question. I think it's a little combination of probably everything. I think everybody wants to serve a mission and a purpose that's greater for them, and also they want to have fun doing it. And so I think so oftentimes you can come to work and you can get stuck in a cubicle and it's the same ho-hum thing. And you may love what you're doing, but you're bored or the culture is, you know, not fun. And so we've really tried. We have amazing members and, you know, they're always in and out of the office. We're always out at the offices. I mean, we were here, you know, mm-hmm. a month or so ago. And so there's always something new. There's new people to interact with. There's new challenges to discover. So it's ever changing. And I think that probably keeps people energized and excited, and it's fun. I mean, we do a lot of networking, which is work, but it's also fun. And so, to me, it's digging into that deeper, like we were all created to do something bigger than ourselves. And if I wake up in the morning and I still have breath in my lungs, then I have a bigger purpose. And so I love to fall into bed at night and be asleep within like 2 minutes because I have given that day everything that I've got and I have nothing left. And so that drives me, and being able to talk about it is good, because sometimes I'll go a week or so and I haven't actually had this conversation. And so it's always re-energizing for me to have that of, I have a purpose every single day when I step out of bed, and I want to know that I'm giving it 150%, because just like the math teachers that impacted us, who knows the conversations that we're having that are impacting lives 10, 15 years from now. And so we have to be on our game every single day. And so that energizes me to think about.
That is my hope for this podcast, and especially this episode. I think that women all over the world need to hear what you have to say. So thank you again so much for coming on. I enjoyed our conversation so much. You're my hero. Keep being awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks for the opportunity. This was so fun.
Thanks.
Yeah.